growing up in New Guinea, as I did, and then going to boarding school in Australia for high school, my early education was all under the Australian system. And since my parents are retired in Australia and my sister lives there, in addition to having all of the relatives there, I have some very close roots. It's sort of an accident of education, as well as partially by choice, that I live in the United States. I had rheumatic fever in my senior year in high school, and the way the system was in the state of Queensland at that time, I would have had to repeat 2 years in order to take the senior exams, which was the equivalent of graduating from high school. And when you're 18, yeah, going on 19 and 20, there is no way I could have gone back to boarding school for another 2 years. Yeah. It would have been unconscionable. So I didn't do it. Well, in this country, I think there is less of a stigma attached to someone in high school at an older age than there was there then. It was just a terrible thing. So I went and stayed with my folks in New Guinea while I was recovering, and then worked in the mission offices for 3 years before deciding that I really wanted to go to college, and came over here, stayed with my aunt and uncle in Minnesota, and went to high school for one semester so I could graduate, and then was able to go on to college here. So, I'm not quite sure how much to tell you about the history and background of Australia. I discovered that a lot of people don't really know. We know that, the average American, knows that Australians are very similar to us in ways of thinking and in sort of an independence and love of democracy. But not too many people realize that actually it's partly our fault that Australia was settled. In 1776, when the American colonies threw the British out, the British didn't have any place to dump their convicts. And so the prisons and the prison hulks, the old ships that they had on the Thames River, rapidly overflowed, and they had to do something with all of these prisoners. In those days, you could get life imprisonment or transportation for something like stealing a loaf of bread to feed your starving child. So it's no wonder that the prisons were overflowing. Captain James Cook had made voyages of exploration along the east coast of Australia. He'd made three voyages, 1768 through 1771, and then he went back again 1772 through 1775, and the third voyage 1776 through 1779. And it was on this last voyage that he was killed in the Hawaiian Islands, and I think I'm correct in that Captain Vancouver was with Cook and finished the voyage, and then Vancouver later returned and did his exploration along the Pacific Northwest coast. The voyage to Australia was very long and hazardous. The ships went from England to the Canary Islands, to Rio de Janeiro, to Cape Town, and then along the treacherous southern Indian Ocean, and then came up around Tasmania, up the east coast. So until there was really a necessity for finding a place to establish a penal colony, the British did not have a particular interest in settling Australia. On January 20th of 1788, Captain Arthur Phillip went ashore at Botany Bay as the governor of the new colony of New South Wales, but they discovered that Botany Bay was not a very hospitable area. There was very little fresh water and barren soil, so they moved north a bit to Port Jackson, which is part of the present Sydney Harbour, and set up the first colony. We know that Australia was settled after the east coast of the United States, but I still have to change gears mentally, realizing how recently Washington and Oregon, the west coast of the U.S., were settled. There were thriving townships at Townsville and Cairns in North Queensland. Thriving settlements in the 1860s and 70s. And I know when I was there visiting my sister in North Queensland for the first time, I really had to do some gear switching to realize that they were settled before Seattle was. The Australian states federated in 1901, and they are now an independent nation, a member of the British Commonwealth of Nations. But there is a very strong Republican movement, and I will not be at all surprised any day to hear that they have withdrawn from the British Commonwealth. There are very strong ties with the United States, especially since World War II. People who were alive during that time freely acknowledged that if it hadn't been for the American forces, Australia would have been overrun by the Japanese. And there's some sense of gratitude for that. The current population of Australia is about 15 million. And when you consider that in geographical area, it is almost the same as the continental United States, you realize that it's very sparsely populated. Part of the reason for that is that huge areas of the interior cannot support human life. There's just simply no water. Other areas where there are settlements, oh, I forget the exact figures, but they require acres and acres and acres per one sheep or one head of cattle. And a lot of the stations are counted in square miles rather than in acres, like 6,000 square miles or whatever.
And what's a station?
A station is a ranch for sheep or cattle. By the square mile rather than by the acre.
Wow.
Yeah, it might be 6,000 square miles.
I just come from a ranch, it's 21 miles long.
Uh-huh.
That's in Montana.
Yeah.
Montana's sparsely populated.
Yeah, yeah. The first poem on our sheets is one by Banjo Paterson, one of the most famous of the Australian poets. He studied to be a lawyer, but after some years gave that up and became a journalist. And then in his later life, he lived as a pastoralist on the upper Murrumbidgee River. A pastoralist, if I have the understanding correctly, is someone who owns property and runs sheep, but it's not necessarily a huge spread, so they may not call it a station. The grazier is the term generally used for those people who owned vast expanses of land and grazed sheep and cattle on them. Even if you've never heard of Banjo Paterson before, I'm sure that you've heard of one of his works. He wrote the words to Waltzing Matilda, which everybody seems to know, and which some Australians consider to be the national song, if not exactly the national anthem. Did any of you happen to see the movie Clancy of the Overflow The Man from Snowy River a couple of years ago?
Yes.
Okay, Clancy, the character in that is the same Clancy, Clancy of the Overflow. The Overflow, I believe I have my geography right. The Lachlan River is part of the vast river system in southern New South Wales and Victoria, and the overflow refers to the fertile area that is watered by this network of rivers. I had written him a letter, which I had, for want of better knowledge, sent to where I met him down the Lachlan years ago. He was shearing when I knew him, so I sent the letter to him, just on spec, addressed as follows. Clancy of the Overflow. And an answer came directed in a writing unexpected, and I think the same was written with a thumbnail dipped in tar. 'Twas his shearing mate who wrote it, and verbatim I will quote it. Clancy's gone to Queensland droving, and we don't know where he are. In my wild erratic fancy, visions come to me of Clancy gone a-droving down the Cooper where the western drovers go. As the stock are slowly stringing, Clancy rides behind them singing, for the drover's life has pleasures that the townsfolk never know. And the bush has friends to meet him, and their kindly voices greet him in the murmur of the breezes and the river on its bars. And he sees the vision splendid of the sunlit plains extended, and at night the wondrous glory of the everlasting stars. I am sitting in my dingy little office, where a stingy ray of sunlight struggles feebly down between the houses tall, and the fetid air and gritty of the dusty, dirty city through the open window floating spreads its foulness over all. And in place of lowing cattle, I can hear the fiendish rattle of the tramways and the buses making hurry down the street. And the language uninviting of the gutter children fighting comes fitfully and faintly through the ceaseless tramp of feet. And the hurrying people daunt me, and their pallid faces haunt me, as they shoulder one another in their rush and nervous haste, with their eager eyes and greedy, and their stunted forms and weedy, for townsfolk have no time to grow, they have no time to waste. And I somehow rather fancy that I'd like to change with Clancy, like to take a turn at droving where the seasons come and go, while he faced the round eternal of the cash book and the journal. But I doubt he'd suit the office, Clancy of the overflow. In Australia, the term bush refers to the country, especially remote country. Holden is out in the bush.
Yeah.
It has nothing to do with vegetation. It's sort of a philosophical idea of what the bush is. A drover, we would probably call a cowboy. A drover was a person who went into the various regions of the outback and gathered up the animals that the grazier would have for sale, and he would have a huge mob growing all along of sheep or cattle that he was then responsible for taking to the railhead and shipping off to the city for meat or whatever. Drovers may have ridden horses, not necessarily. They may have gone on foot just with dogs. But the pace of the journey was regulated by the pace at which the animals could move through the countryside. And some of the distances, it was not uncommon for some of the long droving trails to be several thousand miles in length. The Australian word mate doesn't really have any equivalent in American English. It does not mean male and female partners. Your mate is your good friend. Your mates are people who would probably die for you. They may heap abuse on you. In fact, that's one of the interesting things about Australian English. It's sort of a cheerful, almost unconscious profanity. And your mates can call you a bloody idiot or a flaming so-and-so, but if anybody else who was a stranger dared call you a flaming idiot, your mate would probably give him a knuckle sandwich in your defense. So a mate is a good person to have around. The second poem on your sheets is one by James Haxton, and I put the name Hal Guy in parentheses after it, because apparently Hal Guy was an illustrator who had illustrated volumes of Australian poetry, and a few years later, some humorous stories and sketches by James Haxton began appearing in the Bulletin, which is, I suppose the Bulletin was sort of the equivalent of the Saturday Review. It was a literary journal. And the editors of this little book from which I took the poem say that when they wrote to Haxton and Guy separately to ask Haxton to ask permission to put this poem in the book, permission came back. We agree with your suggestion. Haxton and Guy are not to be kept secret anymore, and the letter was signed twice. First was Hal Guy in small, neat, artistic hand, then underneath it, huge and flourishing, James Haxton, one and the same person who had developed two personas for his work. One of the pictures that I had on the sheet to show you was a corrugated iron tank on my cousin's farm. Water tanks are tremendously important in Australia to catch the small amount of rainfall. A lot of the underground water that is there, it has a high mineral content, so it really isn't good for humans to consume. So the rainwater tank is especially important. I think the only term you might need to know is tap. Australians never speak about faucets. You have taps in your bathtub. You have taps in the kitchen sink. Our corrugated iron tank. Our tank stood on a crazy stand, bare to the burning sky, white hot as glares the desert sand, and dismal to the eye. Its lid was like a rakish hat, the tap all bent awry, and with a drip so constant that it almost dripped when dry. It was a most convenient tank, wherein most things could fall, where snakes came from the bush and drank, and rabbits used to call, and mice committed suicide. The gum leaves sank to rest, and in it possums dropped and died, and hornets made their nest. But, stark within my memory, I see it once again, when we looked at it anxiously, days when we hoped for rain. I hear the hollow sounds it made like some prophetic drum as I tapped rung on rung, afraid of dreadful days to come. When mother in despair would pray as low the water sank, four rungs, three rungs, two rungs, and aye, how miserly we drank, and there was none for face or hands, waste was a wicked thing, there in the baked and parching lands, with hope our only spring. Next came the fatal one rung left, how cruel words can be, as we stood of all joys bereft, dumb in our misery. And then I tapped the tank in pain, those nils of drought and doom. Our tank at last had gone dry again, our home cast down in gloom. But oh, the joy that filled our hearts when came the bounteous rain, and the drain pipes sang in fits and starts and filled the tank again. We felt as if we'd riches won, that life again was sweet, and overjoyed then everyone. We even washed our feet. Habitual barefootedness on the part of children.
That's great. That conjures up for me pictures of being on the farm in Wisconsin. You know, probably not the same sort of, you know, drought kind of condition, but I remember one summer sitting on the front porch of our house with my mother when it finally rained, and we both just sat in it.
Yeah. Yeah, you just go out in the rain and
the glory of it.
Yes.
And then to watch the lightning storm too.
The next one on the second page is the one that I mentioned to you the day that we looked at Hopkins's poetry as being one that I remembered from my first year of high school. And I'm not sure why Pied Beauty and The Day of the Kingfisher made an impression on me, but they both did.
Edie, what do you have on the dates here?
I have the question marks because I don't know if the people are dead or not. This book that I took the poems from gave the years of all of these poets, but the book was published in 1961. So it's out of date, and I did some checking in the library in Seattle, and I couldn't find anything. There are some collections of poetry that included Australian poets, but I couldn't find anything that really indicated their deaths or not. A term that you might need to know for this one is, in about the fifth, sixth line, Banksias. Banksias are bottle brushes. They're a flowering bush that has red or yellow or pink blossoms about like that, that look like a bottle brush, a central core with the little fuzz all the way around. Banksias are named after Sir Joseph Banks, the botanist who sailed with Captain Cook and catalogued the Australian flora and fauna. The only other thing you might need to know, down near the bottom, there's the term soak, and that's in a river bed during a drought when the river has stopped flowing. First there are little water holes, and then as the dry weather continues, there might be places where the sand is only just barely moist until the rain comes and the river starts flowing again. Day of the Kingfisher. Look, look, see, the kingfisher comes, there where the white log splits the pool. Oh, the blue flash of him like from a thundercloud. See, there he goes, over the rockfall. Now where the Banksia is by the creek's elbow leans scarlet to scarlet. Oh, how he flashes. Look, look. Ah, he is gone. Yet for his coming the laurel more vibrant, bolder the bronze of young leaf on the fig, and softer too the gloom-thought green of she-oak. How all things now are lovelier since he came. So as bird, this day has flashed my stream, along its lean banks and snake-like turnings, its sun-tongued reaches, its deep-snagged pools, lighting the gloom where thought oppresses, livening the hope of half-despairing prayer, making more dear the things already cherished, and so will flash from hole to failing hole, from failing hole to soak, until the bed is choked with moistless sand and lost all traces of a stream. Ah, lady, then will God be good if down the hidden course my soul must take, the memory of this day that you have given will speed with it to comfort and to bless. In the third stanza, the stream is a metaphor for life, and he's looking forward to arid times and the part that the memory of this day will have. I'd like to just read to you what Paul Grano has said about the poem himself. The poem was occasioned by the appearance of a kingfisher when a woman friend and I were hiking along Inaugura Creek, some 6 miles out of Brisbane. There are moments, very few, when a sudden keen perception of beauty in nature stirs me deeply. This was one, lasting perhaps a much shorter time than it takes to read the first 7 lines of the poem. Maybe those lines convey something of the excitement I felt at the time. The next 4 lines tell of the after effects, how the loveliness of all things is enhanced by such moments of perception. In the next 10 lines, I consider how such an experience and the memory of it brighten and bless one's life, of which the stream here is the symbol. Finally, addressing my companion, I acknowledge her part, in that but for her the hike would not have been made, and express the hope that memories of such moments may be with me after death. My Country by Dorothea McKellar is one that is included in almost every grade school and high school literature or music program somewhere. Dorothea McKellar was the only poet for which I do not have the dates. Let's see. No, I have no idea about her dates at all. In the comments that she writes on the poem, she says, "One day when I was 19, I was talking with a friend of the same age about anti-Australianism and how we both vehemently disliked it, and that inspired her to write this poem." But she must have been around the turn of the century, I think, because I know my cousins, who are considerably older than I am, quote this, so they learned it when they were in school.
Is there a general feeling among Australians of being sort of left out of the mainstream and resenting that? Or?
Not so much now. I think possibly up to the 50s. World War II did an awful lot to change that. Previously, there was a very definite feeling that Australia was just a place where people went, but it wasn't their real home. Anyone who had immigrated from England still, till their dying day, would refer to England as home, or people who had immigrated from Germany, as my mother's family did, still sort of had the feeling that Australia was a wonderful place to live, and it was a land of great opportunity, but Germany was the real home. And I think probably since World War II, when Australia was plummeted into the center of the Pacific War and in the center of the focus of the war in the Pacific, that has changed somewhat. And I would say for maybe about the last 15 years or so, Australia is home. And that has been helped too by a greater influx of immigrants in the 50s and 60s, people from the European countries who have left difficult conditions there and have come to Australia for economic betterment or for freedom. And the fact of it being a melting pot is helping somewhat too. In the early years of the settlement, I think the immigrants were largely English or German. And there were a few Norwegians and a few others, but the great immigration of the 50s and early 60s brought Italians and Spaniards and Yugoslavs and Hungarians and Czechoslovakians, a lot of war refugees, and that melting pot has helped the perception of Australia as a good country to claim as home.
Are there many Asians?
There are a few. For many, many years, there is what was known as, quotation marks, the White Australia policy, which severely limited the number of Asian immigrants. And New Guinea played a role in changing that policy because there were many Asians who had been born in New Guinea, in the part of it that was the Australian Trust Territory. So having been born there, they were in effect Australian citizens, and the Australian Immigration Service found that when these people wanted to come to Australia, they couldn't very well keep them out because they had been born as citizens. And that helped the easing of the White Australia policy. But there still is somewhat of an anti-Asian feeling, although I think that's changing in recent years too, with the acknowledgement that Australia really is part of Southeast Asia rather than part of Europe or part of North America. They, geographically, they are so closely aligned with Southeast Asia that there has to be greater cooperation and conversation.
What about you? Do you, you mentioned, you know, you squeaked by it being an American citizen. Do you consider going to live there again?
I think I could live there quite cheerfully, but I'm not sure about working there. Australia, now in terms of, pardon the expression, male chauvinism, is about where the United States was 15 years ago.
I wondered where.
And well, even up until about 5 or 6 years ago, they really wanted people to come and help the workforce. I know several people who were teachers in America went to Australia to teach for 2 or 3 years in the schools there. And about 5 years ago, that changed because of the economic situation there being the same as it is here with the recession and so on. And now there is a very, very strong feeling against anyone coming in to take a job that could be held by an Australian. If you have medical expertise or scientific or technological expertise that is rare in Australia, then you could be given a visa permitting you to come in and work. But otherwise, just ordinary people like teachers and nurses and secretaries and whatnot, they welcome you as a visitor, very glad to take your American dollars as a tourist, but not so eager to have you stay and work.
I had some friends that went there and taught from college, about 10 years
ago. Yeah, that would have been about the peak of the of the teacher program.
And they said the same thing, they came back.
I think possibly to go as half a couple would be a lot easier to go than to go as a single woman. I know my parents write about the great shortage of pastors in the Lutheran Church in Australia. And I have a friend, a woman friend, who graduated from Luther Seminary and then went for quite some time without call. And I asked her once if she'd thought about going to Australia because I knew that there was a great interest and concern about having more pastors. And she said the thought had occurred to her, but she was also given very strong indications that the Australian church would not accept a female clergy. So she gave up the idea of pursuing that. I kind of like this little poem, Kangaroos. I'm assuming that most of you have seen a kangaroo, at least in a zoo. I'm not sure that I have ever seen a herd of kangaroos hopping across a paddock. Get terminology straight here. But this poem does a good job of painting the picture. Kangaroos. Brown out of the brown tussock, a darker brown head rises as if thrust up cautiously on a pole. A green bird on a feathering grass stem that bends under its weight flutters and sinks out of sight. It is the only disturbance except for the reiterated clicking of castanets and the fife notes of insects. One notices the head gone, pulled down out of sight like the vanished bird. But all over the unfurled map of the landscape, minute brown figures, dots, jump, all diminishing, yet each pursuing lines that intersect, making a maze of crazy map lines, meaningless angles. The skin of the land is a deep fur, maddeningly come alive with deliberate great fleas. Judith Wright, born in 1915, and at least in October of 1982 was still alive. She now lives at Tambourine, which is on the mountain ridge about 10 miles in the hinterland from where my parents live. And I took a bus tour around on the to some of the scenic areas in the mountains one day, and the bus driver pointed out, we couldn't see Judith Wright's house, but he pointed out the road down which her house was. So, you know, that she was still alive and writing at that time. She has written a lot, giving a feeling of the country, of what it means to be Australian, of taking pride in being Australian. And about this one, Black Cockatoos, she says that it comes from a series of poems about Australian birds that she has written. I am not interested exactly in describing the birds or telling the reader about them, but in using birds as starting points for verses that will express something that I want to say, something that may not have much connection with the birds themselves. Perhaps this is the most important thing about writing poetry, that it is or can be a way of finding the meaning of one's own experience. And again, the image here is of a very dry period, waiting for the rain to come, and she sees the black cockatoos as a symbol of the coming of the rain, a modified sonnet. Each certain kind of weather or of light has its own creatures. Somewhere else they wait, as though they but inhabited heat or cold, twilight or dawn, and knew no other state. Then at their time they come, timid or bold. So when the long drought winds, sandpaper harsh, were still, and the air changed and the clouds came, and the other birds were quiet in prayer or fear, these knew their hour. Before the first far flash lit up, or the first thunder spoke its name, in heavy flight they came, till I could hear the wild black cockatoos, tossed on the crest of their high trees, crying the world's unrest. It's somehow very fitting that the cockatoos represent the storm, with the dark clouds and the harsh sounds of the coming storm. Cockatoos do not have beautiful voices. They're very harsh cries. The Queensland dog, you can have fun reading for yourself. Just a couple of terms. We've already mentioned what a station is. A boundary rider is a fence rider. On the vast properties, they would employ a man just to ride along the fences and make sure that they were up and that the cattle or sheep hadn't strayed. In the second line, a schooner is a beer. I have not ever been into a bar, but I don't really like beer that well. And Australian beer is stronger than American beer. Yeah. One of the great Australian occupations is drinking beer. So beer comes either in middies, which are small glasses, or schooners, which are large glasses. So, I've got a short story that I really want to read to you, if I can get through it without breaking down into helpless giggles. If I do that, somebody can just whack me on the back. Banjo Patterson and Henry Lawson are the two great granddaddies of Australian literature. And we've read Banjo Patterson's poem, and the story I'd like to read to you is by Henry Lawson. Just read you a little bit about him. His dates are 1867 to 1822. He was born in a tent on the Grenfell goldfield in New South Wales. His father was a Norwegian seaman, Peter Larsen, who had left his ship to look for gold in Australia. The gold rush in Australia came just as the California gold rush was petering out. So a lot of people left California and went to Australia in pursuit of wealth. And then the Alaska gold rush came sort of after the Australian gold rush had petered out. So there was quite a span of years where people traveled the world in search of gold. Henry had little education and for most of his life was handicapped by deafness, which first afflicted him when he was 10 and of which he was never cured. He worked at various jobs, painter, clerk, journalist, teacher, and made several trips to Western Australia and New Zealand. He went to London in 1900, but returned in 1902, and spent most of the rest of his life in Sydney. He died in Sydney in 1922 and was given a state funeral. Lawson and Patterson carried on a kind of verse debate in the Bulletin. Lawson criticized Patterson as a city bushman, who wrote as if the outback life were usually happy and rollicking. And Patterson alleged that Lawson saw only the grim and gloomy side of the bush. Well, this story is a direct refutation of the fact that, of the charge that Lawson saw only the gloomy side of bush life. A couple of terms that you should know. Treacle is light molasses. So when I talk about a treacle tin, that's a tin that molasses came in. Scrub means brush or light woods, like along a creek bank. If you talk about the cattle getting themselves lost up in the scrub, you mean that they've gone up into the brush and have to be searched for. Publican does not mean the same thing as in the Old Testament. A publican is a hotel keeper. And a hotel, excuse me, a hotel was a place chiefly in existence for the bar. I think there were some legal restrictions. A hotel had to provide a certain minimum number of rooms for accommodation, and the publican's wife had to be willing to provide minimal meals for travelers who happened to stay. But the main business for having an establishment like that was for the bar, where people could go to buy their beer. So the publican is the hotel keeper. The name of the story is The Loaded Dog. Dave Regan, Jim Bentley, and Andy Page were sinking a shaft at Stony Creek in search of a rich gold quartz reef which was supposed to exist in the vicinity. There is always a rich reef supposed to exist in the vicinity. The only questions are whether it is 10 feet or hundreds beneath the surface, and in which direction. They had struck some pretty solid rock, also water, which kept them bailing. They used the old-fashioned blasting powder and time fuse. They'd make a sausage or cartridge of blasting powder in a skin of strong calico or canvas, the mouth sewn and bound around the end of a fuse. They'd dip the cartridge in melted tallow to make it watertight, get the drill hole as dry as possible, drop in the cartridge with some dry dust, and wad and ram with stiff clay and broken brick. Then they'd light the fuse and get out of the hole and wait. The result was usually an ugly pothole in the bottom of the shaft and half a barrow load of broken rock. There were plenty of fish in the creek, freshwater bream, cod, catfish, and tailors. The party were fond of fish, and Andy and Dave of fishing. Andy would fish for 3 hours at a stretch if encouraged by a nibble or bite now and then, say once in 20 minutes. The butcher was always willing to give meat in exchange for fish when they caught more than they could eat. But now it was winter, and these fish wouldn't bite. However, the creek was low, just a chain of muddy water holes, from the hole with a few bucketfuls in it to the sizable pool with an average depth of 6 or 7 feet, and they could get fish by bailing out the smaller holes or by muddying up the water in the larger ones till the fish rose to the surface. There was the catfish with spikes growing out of the sides of its head, and if you got pricked, you'd know it, as Dave said. Andy took off his boots, tucked up his trousers, and went into a hole one day to stir up the mud with his feet, and he knew it. Dave scooped one out with his hand and got pricked, and he knew it, too. His arm swelled, and the pain throbbed up into his shoulder and down into his stomach, too, he said, like a toothache he had once, and kept him awake for 2 nights. Only the toothache pain had a burred edge, Dave said. Dave got an idea. Why not blow the fish up in the big water hole with a cartridge, he said. I'll try it. He thought the thing out, and Andy Page worked it out. Andy usually put Dave's theories into practice if they were practicable, or bore the blame for failure and the chaffing of his mates if they weren't. He made a cartridge about 3 times the size of those they used in the rock. Jim Bentley said it was big enough to blow the bottom out of the river. The inner skin was of stout calico. Andy stuck the end of a 6-foot piece of fuse well down in the powder and bound the mouth of the bag firmly to it with whipcord. The idea was to sink the cartridge in the water with the open end of the fuse attached to a float on the surface, ready for lighting. Andy dipped the cartridge in melted beeswax to make it watertight. "We'll have to leave it some time before we light it," said Dave, "to give the fish time to get over their scare when we put it in and come nosing around again. So we'll want it well watertight." Around the cartridge, Andy, at Dave's suggestion, bound a strip of sail canvas that they used for making water bags to increase the force of the explosion, and round that he pasted layers of stiff brown paper on the plan of the sort of fireworks we call gun crackers. He let the paper dry in the sun, Then he sewed a covering of 2 thicknesses of canvas over it and bound the thing from end to end with stout fishing line. Dave's schemes were elaborate, and he often worked his inventions out to nothing. The cartridge was rigid and solid enough now, a formidable bomb. But Andy and Dave wanted to be sure. Andy sewed on another layer of canvas, dipped the cartridge in melted tallow, twisted the length of fencing wire around it as an afterthought, dipped it in tallow again, and stood it carefully against a tent peg, where he'd know where to find it, and wound the fuse loosely around it. Then he went to the campfire to try some potatoes which were boiling in their jackets in a billy, and to see about frying some chops for dinner. Dave and Jim were at work in the claim that morning. They had a big black young retriever dog, or rather an overgrown pup, a big foolish 4-footed mate, who was always slobbering around them and lashing their legs with his heavy tail that swung around like a stock whip. Most of his head was usually a red, idiotic, slobbery grin of appreciation of his own silliness. He seemed to take life, the world, his 2-legged mates, and his own instinct as a huge joke. He'd retrieve anything. He carted back most of the camp rubbish that Andy threw away. They had a cat that died in hot weather, and Andy threw it a good distance away in the scrub. And early one morning the dog found the cat, after it had been dead a week or so, and carried it back to camp and laid it just inside the tent flaps, where it could best make its presence known when the mates should rise and begin to sniff suspiciously in the sickly smothering atmosphere of the summer sunrise. He used to retrieve them when they went in swimming. He'd jump in after them and take their hands in his mouth and try to swim out with them, scratching their naked bodies with his paws. They loved him for his good-heartedness and his foolishness, but when they wished to enjoy a swim, they had to tie him up in camp. He watched Andy with great interest all the morning, making the cartridge, and hindered him considerably, trying to help. But about noon he went off to the claim to see how Dave and Jim were getting on, and to come home to dinner with them. Andy saw them coming and put a pan full of mutton chops on the fire. Andy was cooked today. Dave and Jim stood with their backs to the fire, as bushmen do in all weathers, waiting till dinner should be ready. The retriever went nosing around after something he seemed to have missed. Andy's brain still worked on the cartridge. His eye was caught by the glare of an empty kerosene tin lying in the bushes, and it struck him that it wouldn't be a bad idea to sink the cartridge packed with clay, sand, or stones in the tin to increase the force of the explosion. He may have been all out from a scientific point of view, but the notion looked all right to him. Jim Bentley, by the way, wasn't interested in their damned silliness. Andy noticed an empty treacle tin, the sort with a little tin neck or spout soldered onto the top for the convenience of pouring out the treacle, and it struck him that this would have made the best kind of cartridge case. He would only have had to pour in the powder, stick the fuse in through the neck, cork and seal it with beeswax. He was turning to suggest this to Dave, when Dave glanced over his shoulder to see how the chops were doing, and bolted. He explained afterwards that he thought he heard the pan spluttering extra, and looked behind to see if the chops were burning. Jim Bentley looked behind and bolted after Dave. Andy stood stock still, staring after them. "Run, Andy, run!" they shouted back at him. "Run! Look behind you, you fool!" Andy turned slowly and looked, and there, close behind him, was the retriever with the cartridge in his mouth, wedged into his broadest and silliest grin. And that wasn't all. The dog had come around the fire to Andy, and the loose end of the fuse had trailed and waggled over the burning sticks into the blaze. Andy had slit and nicked the firing end of the fuse well, and now it was hissing and spitting properly. Andy's legs started with a jolt. His legs started before his brain did, and he made after Dave and Jim, and the dog followed Andy. Dave and Jim were good runners, Jim the best, for a short distance. Andy was slow and heavy, but he had the strength and the wind and could last. The dog capered around him, delighted as a dog could be to find his mates, as he thought, on for a frolic. Dave and Jim kept shouting back, "Don't follow us! Don't follow us, you blankety fool!" But Andy kept on, no matter how they dodged. They could never explain, any more than the dog, why they followed each other.
Yes.
But so they ran, Dave keeping in Jim's track in all its turnings, Andy after Dave, and the dog circling Andy, the live fuse swishing in all directions and hissing and spluttering and stinking. Jim yelling to Dave not to follow him, Dave shouting to Andy to go in another direction, to spread out, and Andy roaring at the dog to go home. Then Andy's brain began to work, stimulated by the crisis. He tried to get a running kick at the dog, but the dog dodged. He snatched up sticks and stones and threw them at the dog and ran on again. The retriever saw that he'd made a mistake about Andy and left him and bounded after Dave. Dave, who had the presence of mind to think that the fuse's time wasn't up yet, made a dive and a grab for the dog, caught him by the tail, and as he swung around, snatched the cartridge out of his mouth and flung it as far as he could. The dog immediately bounded after it and retrieved it. Dave roared and cursed at the dog, who, seeing that Dave was offended, left him and went after Jim, who was well ahead. Jim swung to a sapling and went up it like a native bear. It was a young sapling, and Jim couldn't safely get more than 10 or 12 feet from the ground. The dog laid the cartridge as carefully as if it were a kitten at the foot of the sapling, and capered and leaped and whooped joyously around under Jim. The big pup reckoned that this was part of the lark. He was all right now. It was Jim who was out for a spree. The fuse sounded as if it were going a mile a minute. Jim tried to climb higher, and the sapling bent and cracked. Jim fell on his feet and ran. The dog swooped up the cartridge and followed. It all took but a very few moments. Jim ran to a digger's hole about 10 feet deep and dropped down into it, landing on soft mud, and was safe. The dog grinned sardonically down on him over the edge for a moment, as if he thought it would be a good lark to drop the cartridge down on Jim. "Go away, Tommy," Jim said feebly. "Go away." The dog bounded off after Dave, who was the only one in sight now. Andy had dropped down behind a log, where he lay flat on his face, having suddenly remembered a picture of the Russo-Turkish War, with a circle of Turks lying flat on their faces, as if they were ashamed, around a newly arrived shell. There was a small hotel or shanty on the creek, on the main road, not far from the claim. Dave was desperate. The time flew much faster in his stimulated imagination than it did in reality, so he made for the shanty. There were several casual bushmen on the veranda and in the bar. Dave rushed into the bar, banging the door to behind him. "My dog," he gasped in reply to the astonished stare of the publican. "The Blanky Retriever! He's got a live cartridge in his mouth!" The retriever, finding the front door shut against him, had bounded round and in by the back way, and now stood smiling in the doorway leading from the corridor, the cartridge still in his mouth and the fuse spluttering. They burst out of that bar. Tommy bounded first after one and then after the other, for, being a young dog, he tried to make friends with everybody. The bushmen ran around corners, and some shut themselves in the stable. There was a new weatherboard and corrugated iron kitchen and wash house on pilings in the backyard, with some women washing clothes inside. Dave and the publican bundled in there and shut the door, the publican cursing Dave and calling him a crimson fool in hurried tones, and wanting to know what the hell he came here for. The retriever went in under the kitchen, amongst the pilings, but, luckily for those inside, there was a vicious yellow mongrel cattle dog skulking and nursing his nastiness under there. A sneaking, fighting, thieving canine, whom neighbors had tried for years to shoot or poison. Tommy saw his danger. He'd had experience from this dog, and started out across the yard, still sticking to the cartridge. Halfway across the yard, the yellow dog caught him and nipped him. Tommy dropped the cartridge, gave one terrified yell, and took to the bush. The yellow dog followed him to the fence, and then ran back to see what he had dropped. Nearly a dozen other dogs came from around all the corners and under the buildings. Spidery, thievish, cold-blooded kangaroo dogs, mongrel sheep and cattle dogs, vicious black and yellow dogs that slip after you in the dark, nip your heels, and then vanish without explaining, and yapping, yelping small fry. They kept at a respectable distance around the yellow dog, for it was dangerous to go near him when he thought he had found something which might be good for a dog or a cat. He sniffed at the cartridge twice, and was just taking a third cautious sniff when... It was very good blasting powder. A new brand that David recently got up from Sydney, and the cartridge had been excellently well made. Andy was very patient and painstaking in all he did, and nearly as handy as the average sailor with needles, twine, canvas, and rope. Bushmen say that that kitchen jumped off its pilings and on again.
Oh, boy.
When the smoke and dust cleared away, the remains of the nasty yellow dog were lying on the paling fence of the yard, looking as if he had been kicked into a fire by a horse and afterwards rolled in the dust under a barrow and finally thrown against the fence from a distance. Several saddle horses, which had been hanging around the veranda, were galloping wildly down the road in clouds of dust, with broken bridle reins flying. And from a circle around the outskirts, from every point of the compass in the scrub, came the yelping of dogs. Two of them went home to the place where they were born, 30 miles away, and reached it that same night and stayed there. It was not until towards evening that the rest came back cautiously to make inquiries. One was trying to walk on two legs, and most of them looked more or less singed. And a little singed, stumpy-tailed dog, who had been in the habit of hopping the back half of him along on one leg, had reason to be glad that he'd saved up the other leg all those years, for he needed it now. There was one old one-eyed cattle dog around that shanty for years afterwards who couldn't stand the smell of a gun being cleaned. He it was who had taken an interest only second to that of the yellow dog in the cartridge. Bushman said that it was amusing to slip up on his blind side and stick a dirty ramrod under his nose. He wouldn't wait to bring his solitary eye to bear. He'd take to the bush and stay out all night. For half an hour or so after the explosion, there were several bushmen around behind the stable who crouched doubled up against the wall or rolled gently in the dust, trying to laugh without shrieking. There were two white women in hysterics in the house and a half-caste rushing aimlessly around with a dipper of cold water. The publican was holding his wife tight and begging her between squawks, "Hold up for my sake, Mary, or I'll lamb the life out of ye."
Jeez.
Dave decided to apologize later on when things had settled a bit and went back to camp. And the dog that had done it all, Tommy the great idiotic mongrel retriever, came slobbering around Dave and lashing his legs with his tail and trotted home after him, smiling his broadest, longest, reddest smile of amiability, apparently satisfied for one afternoon with the fun he'd had.
Oh,
Andy chained up the dog securely and cooked some more chops while Dave went to help Jim out of the hole. And most of this is why, for years afterwards, lanky, easy-going bushmen riding lazily past Dave's camp would cry in a lazy drawl, and just with a hint of nasal twang, "Hello, Dave. How's the fishing getting on, Dave?" That's all I have. Unless you'd...
Can we read over the one, My Country?
Oh, yes, yeah, sure. I can read that.
The last one?
Okay, we can just read those.
The nicest of here. That's nicest.
I wish I had kept my Australian accent. No, I wished, but I was embarrassed about it. So when I first came over here to go to college, I worked at losing it. My sister, who had all of her education in Australia, sounds very Australian, and we have fun sometimes when we're together at a restaurant or somewhere. I'll talk American and she'll talk Australian, and nobody in the world would guess that we were sisters. My Country by Dorothea McKellar. The love of field and coppice, of green and shaded lanes, of ordered woods and gardens is running in your veins. Strong love of gray-blue distance, brown streams, and soft dim skies. I know, but cannot share it. My love is otherwise. I love a sunburnt country, a land of sweeping plains, of ragged mountain ranges, of droughts and flooding rains. I love her far horizons, I love her jewel sea, her beauty and her terror, the wide brown land for me. The tragic ring-barked forests, stark white beneath the moon, the sapphire-misted mountains, the hot gold hush of noon, green tangle of the brushes where lithe lianas coil, and orchids deck the treetops, and ferns the crimson soil. Core of my heart, my country, Her pitiless blue sky, when sick at heart around us we see the cattle die. But when the gray clouds gather and we can bless again the drumming of an army, the steady, soaking rain. Core of my heart, my country, land of the rainbow gold, of flood and fire and famine, she pays us back threefold. Over the thirsty paddocks watch, after many days, the filmy veil of greenness that thickens as we gaze. An opal-hearted country, a willful, lavish land. All you who have not loved her, you will not understand. Though earth holds many splendors, wherever I may die, I know to what brown country my homing thoughts will fly. In the little book on North Queensland, there's a picture there of the Narada tea plantation at Innisfail, where you can see the crimson soil with the green tea bushes through it. And throughout most of North Queensland, the soil really is that bright red. A lot of the country is volcanic, and the volcanic soil tends to be either very black or the bright red. It ranges sort of in color from an orange color to what is literally a raspberry pink. Just incredible. Around Cairns, where my sister lives, one of the major industries is sugar cane. And the sugar has to grow for several years, and the color of it indicates the stages that it is. The newly little planted seedlings, or I guess they're little stalks of cane that have sprouted, and they plant them out in the fields, just the very bright, almost chartreuse green with the red soil between the rows is just a beautiful picture. So when she talks about ferns decking the crimson soil, she's not just using a figure of speech. The soil really is crimson in many places.
Did they have a lot of hay there?
Yeah, in a lot of the areas they do bale hay. Mm-hmm. Oh, let's read the Queensland dog too. Queensland has sort of been the stepchild of Australia for many years. I'm not sure why. The cultured people from Sydney and Melbourne, even though they have rivalry between them, they unite in looking down on Queensland. Queensland is sort of the country cousin of the States. And it was really nice when I was there in 1982. I just happened to be there during the time of the Commonwealth Games, when athletes came from all over the British Commonwealth to participate in games. They were held in Brisbane. Brisbane did a grand thing. They had an absolutely spectacular opening ceremony. They had housing arranged. They had transportation arranged. They had wonderful venues for the athletic events. And some of the commentators who had come from Sydney and Melbourne, one of them even said, you know, I've been downgrading Queensland all these years, but I really have to say that Queensland has put on a wonderful show, and we're really glad to see it. So I think Queensland, in a sense, is coming of age. But anyway, that downgrading of Queensland is part of what makes this poem funny, The Queensland Dog. A stranger came from New South Wales, and he was tall and brown. He lined beside us at the bar. He sank his schooners down. And all the time, to pass the time, he told us doubtful tales of the country he laid claim to, remarkable New South Wales. With soil so rich and fertile, so ran his line of talk, that pumpkin vines fair sprinted along as fast as a man could walk. He said it took 2 hours sometimes to walk through hollow logs, for timber loomed so broad and too tall. And then he mentioned dogs. Little McGinnis spoke up then, arising from his seat. I dunno about them other things, but at dogs we got you beat. I was boundary riding once, he said, on a station out Longreach way, and lost me bearings among the hills right at the end of day. So I let the old horse poke along and find his own way in the dark, until in the distance I seen a light, and then I heard him bark. Well, station dogs is mostly noise. I never took no heed. I only wanted me bearings, and I could have done with a feed. So I went on riding towards the light, just following me nose, and then I hear him bark again, and this time he's up close. I needn't have worried, he's only a dog, the sort cow cockies keep, that keep the dingoes away at night, and then lay all day and sleep. When he gets near me, he whines a bit, friendly, quiet, and deep. Then he stands on his hind legs and licks me face, and I see his gentle eye and his dusty coat and wagon tail by the starlight in the sky. And the horse I was sitting on at the time was 17 hands high. The stranger paled and admitted, with the wind took out of his sails, that dogs grow bigger in Queensland than they do in New South Wales. I should read you what the poet said about that one. It's kind of fun. He said, when I was firing a boiler for Hume Pipeworks at Meanda near Brisbane, there was a one-eyed Aboriginal called Patch who was employed with me. At Smoko, Smoko is morning coffee break. Except they have tea. At morning tea. If it's fairly formal, it's morning tea. If you just workmen out on the job would have Smoko rather than morning tea. At Smoko one morning, I heard him tell the essential story of the Queensland dog, and this was by no means the only story he told. It appealed especially to my sense of humor, so I thought it might be a good thing to spread it around. If it came to a point, it's not my story, it's really Patch's. All I did was to write it down. I thanked him for it afterwards. His reply was, "That's all right, mate, I got plenty more." One winter morning. Oh, do you know what magpies are?
Birds.
Yeah, black and white birds. Right near where my folks live now, there is a grove of trees, and there are magpies that have had their nests there. And a pair of magpies has come every year since my parents have retired there, which was in 1975. They know it's the same pair because the male has one wounded leg, and he hops. So they call him Hoppy. But the magpies come onto the lawn and beg for food scraps, and of course the mother has bread crusts or anything she throws out for them. And then if the magpie feels like it, he'll sing for them. And just beautiful, magpies are great mimics. They can imitate a variety of songs. So that's part of the image of the magpie here. One winter morning. One winter morning, when the sun was muted by the lifting mist, I saw a dew-bright magpie run along the ground upon the frost with an open beak brimful of song. I stood within the circled mist and watched his singing bring the sun. I saw the glistening of the frost cadenza with his trilling run. The mist rose around us like a song. Like a song, the answer of the sun gave back the world I'd thought well lost. The magpie, thinking this well done, stopped singing. Then, with head down thrust, he nibbled dew. He raised his head. The liquid in his beak he tossed with such a flash of silver sun, it made me laugh. It made me thrust my head like his. And that well done, the mist had gone. I raised my head, and all around me moved the sun. Okay, I could read the story.
Like that,
sure.
Story?
Yeah, that is actually the most uproariously funny one in the book.
That's fun to listen to you and to be able to.
Some of these poems are wonderful.
Yeah.
The Black Cockatoos.
Yeah, well, if you wouldn't mind, I could just read some of these again tomorrow night. And instead of having a discussion type thing, we could just have reading.
That'd be fun.
Right,
okay.
Really nice.
Okay. And people can bring their knitting and whatever. Good. This book, Campfire Tales, my sister just gave me in 1982. It's little selections from the various papers, newspapers from North Queensland about the early pioneer days. And it's just really wonderful. It's like things that I've read about the pioneers here on the West Coast or in Montana or wherever. And the things they don't say are just as important as the things they do. There was one man writing about how he had traveled with his family when he was a small boy from some place to some other place. And he said, whenever I travel that way again, whenever I see a certain large gum tree, I feel sad because that's where my little sister is buried. Not one word about why she died, how she died, or anything else, just that she was buried under that one large gum tree. Yeah, that jollof is just... I like the one where the fellow is dragging the buckets of water up from the creek bank and pouring them into the tank on the sledge. The horses are drinking, and the fellow says, "Oh, I just put 6 packets of Epsom salts in that to soften it up for the washing. Have a nice day."
Oh, my.
So you know what the horses are going to spend the day doing.
Yeah.
Oh, there's one that Mary and John would love. People shopping in town. One woman saying to the other, "I hear the Joneses are going to solar power. They just bought a sun lamp."
Oh, wow. How did you first find out about Holden?
When I was in college in Iowa and then in Concordia in Moorhead, Minnesota, Carol Hingerly in those early years came around to all of the ALC schools every year to ask for volunteer staff.
A little bit better.
Yeah, I came in 1967 and summer of 67 and summer of 68. In fact, in 67 I rode back to Minneapolis with him and his kids. That was an adventure, driving straight through from 25 Mile Creek to Minneapolis. That's the way he does things. It was in the end of August, blistering hot across Montana and North Dakota. Hinderly's daughter, Maren, she's the oldest of their children. In fact, is either just a couple of weeks younger or older than I am. And she was a tiny baby when they were in prison camp in the Philippines.
How long
I think about 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think he was. No, I think he was in the camp. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Oh, that's a good one, isn't it? Oh, that's why you started giggling. Australians don't rent things, they hire them.
Oh.
So you don't rent a costume, you hire a costume. You don't rent a car, you hire a car. Another little difference in the terminology is they don't have takeout food, it's takeaway food.
Mm.
One thing that used to make me laugh, and I guess my sister had seen it so often it didn't strike her as funny, but you know, here our highway sign, the triangular sign says yield. In Australia it says give way.
Oh, wow.
And it makes sense, but I used to always tell my sister, I feel like just coming unglued, just giving way.
What is it saying?
Blend. Oh,
yeah,
instead,
blend.
Instead of merge, it's blend. Yeah, I don't remember about that.
I guess the difference is, yeah, I like hearing Australian English, just to try and see how.
And it's not English.
No, not at all.
An Australian is liable to deck you if you accuse them of speaking nice English or having a nice English accent,
well,
because
it's
Australian.
Funny, U.S. folks, the accents sound similar, but I've heard a lot of British people tell me their least favorite accent is the Australian, even worse than the American, which seems funny to me.
Well, it tends to be slower and a little bit lazier and more drawling. But there's very definitely a difference between standard Australian, such as the newsreaders on TV use, and what you hear in the street or in the shops or whatever. And education is no, the way a person speaks is no indication of how much education he or she may have had. Some very highly educated people deliberately use the everyday slang. They're capable of speaking very beautifully, but in ordinary conversation they prefer to use the drawl. How you going, mate? All right? That's about all I can say in Australian.
You can understand it, though.
Mm-hmm. Right? Oh, yeah. There's an excruciatingly funny book written in the 50s by a man named John O'Grady, and I don't know if John O'Grady was his pen name or his real name, supposedly told in the first person by Nino Colotta, a recently arrived immigrant from Italy, who knew how to speak English very well. He'd studied English, so the editor of the paper for which he worked decided to send him to Australia to do a series of articles on Australia. Well, Nino didn't anticipate any difficulties because he spoke English, and the book is just hilarious, telling about his adventures after he arrived in Australia and then trying to find work so he could assimilate some of the customs of the people and learning about the crazy Australian customs and things are just hilarious. One of the first things he learned, though, was, how you going, mate, all right? They're great abbreviators, and I can't think offhand of abbreviations, but you don't say afternoon, it's avo. What you doing this avo? Wake me up in time for brekka, instead of breakfast. And a lot of the abbreviations, so-called, don't really make the words any shorter. It's just a different way of saying an ordinary thing.
It's a kind of a dialect.
Mm-hmm, it is, yeah. And there are some regional differences, but not nearly as much as in the U.S. For example, here we have New England and Georgia and Texas and Kansas and California and Minnesota and all of North Dakota, half German, and all of those variations. And in Australia, the differences tend to be between radio people and business people who are slight snobs and the ordinary people rather than because of geographical differences. To some extent, but not necessarily. There are people who may talk fairly standard Australian in their jobs, and then when they're at home or just in a casual gathering with friends, go into the dialect. My mother's family, herself and her brothers and sisters, spoke very well, sort of standard English, and I've been wondering about that. I think maybe it's because their families came from Germany, and they were very conscious of trying to speak properly in the new country, whereas my cousins, the next generation down, speak regular Australian.
It's so funny to think how relatively few people there are. I mean, that's three-quarters of the population of California.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. They're magnetic because supposedly they line up north and south along the magnetic lines. There's a picture in there somewhere, too, of the bottle tree, the baobab tree. A sort of malformed, huge trunk and then a few spindly little branches on top. But they are a great thing in dry country because they do have water in the trunks. You don't need to die of thirst if you have a bottle tree anywhere near around.
It's amazing how widespread the eucalyptus tree has become. Mm-hmm. They use that to reforest Peru.
Oh, I didn't know that.
I'm only 13,000 feet elevation, and there's all these slopes that are being reforested with eucalyptus trees.
There are so many kinds of eucalyptus trees. Mm-hmm. And I suppose they adapt to a wide range of... Oh, another interesting thing. Did you know that the macadamia nut is really a native of Queensland? It's the Australian nut. Yep, they call it the Queensland nut there. They're horrors to crack. But apparently, sometime during the early 1800s, a Captain McAdam transplanted some plants to the Hawaiian Islands, where they took over and did very well and are called after him. But they originated in Australia.
Macadam.
So they're macadamia nuts.
Oh, what a strange name to get from that. I just thought it was an indigenous term from somewhere. What kind of relationship exists between Australia and New Zealand?
Not really very close. They're two separate entities. within the British Commonwealth. There's trade to some extent, tourism back and forth between the two countries, but each one tends to sort of mildly despise the other. Australians refer to New Zealanders as Kiwis, sort of slightly disparaging. There are quite a few New Zealanders who have moved to Australia to settle, but they're sort of generally regarded as being a little bit peculiar. I don't think they are. I think it's just the...
So in Australia, do they have New Zealander jokes and New Zealander
Australian probably, jokes? Probably, yeah. There are. Oh, but the big dislike is for Pommies.
Englishmen.
And there are various apocryphal accounts of where that term comes from. One that I heard supposedly that makes some sense is that the early prisoners had P-O-M-E on their garments, Prisoner of Mother England. Huh. And that the Pommy comes from that, but there are other versions. One of my favorite Pommy jokes, though, was told by a bus driver on one tour that I took, a day tour. And one of my cousins was with me who is virulently anti-English, and she didn't think it was funny at all, but I thought it was hilarious. A Pommy went to Australia and was just touring around, and wound up on the coast, on the Gold Coast, south of Brisbane, the resort area, sort of the Miami of Australia. And he liked it there and decided that he'd like to stay a while, but his money was running out, so he knew he'd need to get a job. So he got a newspaper and answered a couple of ads, and sure enough, he was called in for an interview. And one of the questions the interviewer asked him for filling out his forms was, what is your IQ? And the Englishman said, he'd never had an IQ test. He didn't have any idea, but he supposed it would be about 56. And the interviewer said, look, mate, if your IQ was only 56, you wouldn't even have enough sense to tie your own shoes. And the Pommy said, now I get it. I've been wondering why all you Aussies on the coast wear rubber thongs.